And now something that might come in handy as students head back to school. A good tool for searching the web and separating the useful stuff from the web, from the rest. You know what I'm talking about. You use it every day, the search engine Google. Maybe you've heard about the mathematical term Google. Google is a huge number. It's a number with 100 zeros, but you've probably heard of the internet search engine, of course, by a similar name. And in fact, if you've never needed a bit of information in a pinch, I know people say it's cheating, but I use Google to do the crossword puzzle on it because it's so easy to use Google. Sometimes if this song is stuck in your head or you want to find out the name of the author of the music or something, where do you go? You just go right to the search engine, Google, and type it right in. In fact, Google now boasts over 200 million users a day. And one New York Times reporter even likened the cell phone version to God. It knows all the things, all the time, and all those places. And I didn't even know there was a cell phone version of Google. But here to talk about Google are two Google experts. Sergey Brin is president of technology and co-founder of Google in Mountain View, California. He joins us by phone from his office. Welcome there.
Hi, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey. Well, Ryle Dormfest is a co-author of Google Hacks, Google Pocket Guide from O'Reilly Books. He joins us from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Tell us, how did Google get started?
Google started as a research project at Stanford, where my partner Larry Page and I were PhD students in the computer science program. And we were just basically studying what interesting things you could do with the data of the World Wide Web, which when we started back in 1995 was considerably smaller than it is today. But still probably had on the order of like 10 million web pages. So it encompassed a small chunk of human knowledge. And we were just studying what can you do with it, how can you process it, what kind of interesting results can you pull out of it. And eventually what we found was we had the technology to build a great search engine.
Now, how does a search engine search? I mean, does it go, do you track, and I found this out from reading Google Hacks, and I didn't know this, Google does not index every page on the internet, correct?
We try to get as many of them as we can, but we never get all of them.
And so how does it know where to go to get all the pages?
So there are three parts to a search engine. The first part is what we call crawling, and that's actually where we go out and we fetch the pages. And it's much like you would surf the web, you know, you'd click from link to link, from page to page, except we have thousands of computers doing this, and they all do it as quickly as they possibly can. So there are thousands of pages per second that we're crawling, as we call it, or downloading. Then, once we have all of these pages, which there are billions of, what we do is we index them. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of analogous to, you know, you take the encyclopedia and you create, you know, those volumes that are the index, except we do this on much more information, and it's much finer grained. It doesn't, you know, just mm-hmm. tell you, oh, you know, this page talks about such and such. It's much more specific data structure. Mm-hmm. And then the final step is searching, which is when somebody like one of those hundreds of millions of users comes to us with a query, then we access the index and we try to figure out what are the best pages to answer that query.
How much computing power? What are the computers sitting? Are they giant mainframes sitting there? Or what do you use?
So we actually use kind of PCs, which are not unlike the one that you might have at your home, only we have tens of thousands of them.
And no kidding.
And they're spread around the world in different data centers. Mm-hmm. This was one of the things that we just found after coming out of Stanford, where we experimented with many different computing platforms, you know, ranging from kind of the really high-end workstations and servers and things like that. The price performance of just, you know, your commodity PCs was so much better that we could get much more compute power than anyone else mm-hmm. Just by buying kind of off-the-shelf PCs. You know, we do slightly different things than you would typically do at home, but more or less that's what we do.
We're talking about Google this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. If you'd like to join, it's 1-800-989-8255. Ryle Dornfest, reading Google Hacks, I learned so much about the secrets of this. There are hidden layers just inside of Google, are they not? Help us to narrow our searches?
Indeed, you know, the simple search box that you see on the front page belies an enormous complexity and an enormous amount of power in searching. I think most people don't actually discover the power of some of the advanced searches, some of the search syntaxes that are available to you, because it just works so astoundingly well in the first place. They type into the box what they're looking for, and it just usually finds it. It's so successful that the "I'm feeling lucky" button, one of the possibilities. Instead of just hitting search, will take you to the first page, the first result it finds. Even that works astoundingly well. So people are rather used to the simplicity of it and don't really go any further, but there's much more to be had.
We're talking about Google this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Even simple things I learned. If you type your phone number into Google, it gives you the address of the phone number. It could be anywhere in the world. Wow.
Indeed. It's not a complete phone book, of course. The real focus is on the United States, and you can type in phone numbers, and not just your name, but where's pizza joints in town, or and then there is actually a link to a MapQuest map to that pizza joint, after which you can get driving directions, and there are reverse phone lookups too. So if you got caller ID and the phone number is not identified, you can try reverse lookups on Google to actually retrieve the source of that phone number. And there's some interesting hacks you can do. One of the fun things we did in the book was comparing the number of pizza joints in Chicago versus New York based upon the number of results in the phone book lookup. Not necessarily the numbers, but just the results themselves.
What's your favorite hack? What's your favorite unknown secret about Google?
It's interesting. I think that my favorite hack is a very simple one, and that is one that most people overlook, and that is what I like to call "don't sweat spelling." You approach Google, and you have to look at Osteichthyes or Caesar, and God forbid you don't remember how to spell these things. You agonize over it, or you go to dictionary.com and get the spelling, and then type it into Google. You can actually just type into Google the closest approximation you can find. For example, I'm one of the few people in the world who can never seem to spell Britney Spears, and you type that in, and on the next page. If Google determines that you seem to have typed an incorrect spelling, or you might mean something else, it suggests so. It says, "Did you mean?" And it highlights a link, and you click that link and follow it on to the actual results you're looking for. So, a student who's looking up Julius Caesar and types Caesar incorrectly will still be on the right path, rather than getting stuck and saying, "I'm not getting any results. I only got two, and I'm sure there's more out there than that." So, it's a very simple hack, but one that people don't tend to really think of. The other one, one of my favorites, something a little bit more complex, is time travel. You can actually go to Google and tell it that you want to travel back, quote-unquote, in time. So I would like to see all the news around Jerry Halliwell and Spice Girls, but only around May 1998, around that month or before that, to get news about the breakup, or take me back in time where I can see sites that are talking about NASA that are not necessarily talking about the disaster in recent time. So take me back beyond that, take me back before that. It's extremely powerful and is available from the Google Advanced Search page.
Sergey, how often do you update its features?
We probably launch something, even though it may not be like readily apparent, at least on a monthly basis.
No kidding.
And I can mention a couple of recent ones that are fun. One is an extension to the sort of the person who created the spelling correction that Rael mentioned. And by the way, there are about 600 different ways that people misspell Britney Spears, so you're not alone. He also implemented this little feature, which is if you type a mathematical expression, if you type in like 2 plus 2, in the original version it would say, "Did you mean 4? Just like spell correction. Now it has nicer UI, and we've actually launched it. But actually handles pretty complicated mathematical expressions, and you can include all kinds of units, be they kilograms or teaspoons, and you can use complex numbers, all kinds of things.
Any monetary conversion on it?
Yeah. That's something that's been a big request. We have not put that in yet, but I think that would be a good one to add. Perhaps that we should make that next month's additional feature.
All right. You heard it here first. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Sergey Brin and Rael Dornfest about Google and see what the future of search engines are. So stick with us. We'll get to your questions. We'll be right back after the short break. We're talking this hour about where your searching goes on the web. My guests are Sergey Brin, president of technology and co-founder of Google, and Rael Dornfest, co-author of Google Hacks and the Google Pocket Guide. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Good call from Sohail. Welcome to Science Friday in St. Paul.
Hi, thank you. I had a question for... wanted to know that there was a rumor going on the Internet about that whatever demographic data about people and things that Google collects sell to the U.S. government. Is that true, or if they could comment on that?
Okay. What happens? Do you sell data to advertisers or where we're surfing to?
No.
Or the government, as the caller wanted to know?
We don't sell any kind of usage data like that. We do sometimes release aggregate data. For example, you can look at the Google Zeitgeist, which will tell you, say, the top 10 rising queries for a particular week or the top 10 lowering queries. But we don't, sell individual users' data, and in fact, we don't even collect it. For the most part, if you just use Google Search, nobody ever enters their name or anything. Some Google services, like if you're an advertiser or something, then you enter your names and things. But once again, those are just used for internal purposes, like billing and things like that.
Tell us about the economics. You make a lot of money, don't you, on Google?
Well, I like to think that we're a successful business. one of the great successes that we've had, there have been two. One is our AdWords program, which is for advertisers, and we have over 100,000 of them, and they can all get very targeted leads. They'll pick their keywords or the topics of their sites. Like if they sell golf clubs, they'll say, send me the people who are searching for golf clubs. And that's turned out to be a very effective advertising medium because it just has you get people who are interested in what you sell when they are interested, right at that mm-hmm. very moment.
If I say, I want to advertise golf clubs, send me a golf club people, does that mean they appear on the front page higher up in your listing?
No, they don't. Where they appear is on the right-hand side,
right,
with the ads. There are two slots across the top, but those are also clearly marked. We believe it's very important to have clear separation between kind of the search results, which are more like the equivalent of editorial in a magazine, though they're all automated, and the paid placements, which we mark separately and position separately.
Is it possible for you to keep your web pages out of Google if you don't want them on there?
Yeah, there are a variety of ways to do that. One of the standard protocols is called robots.txt. It's been around for a number of years, and it's a way that you can specify which search engines you actually want to crawl your site or not.
Mm. Rael, give us another great Google hack from your book.
Restricting, I believe I already mentioned restricting by domain, but perhaps I didn't. Restricting by domain, you can actually, there's a really rich expressive syntax that allows you to search across certain metadata, so you can look for things inside the title only of the page or inside the content of the page. One of my favorites is actually being able to search by site, so you can say, show me things that are being said about NASA, but not on this NASA site itself. So you would search for NASA minus site colon NASA.gov, and you'd get NASA Watch and various different sites that are talking about NASA, but not necessarily NASA itself. Mm-hmm. And it's rather useful. Another one to apply that to is, for example, you're looking at book information, but all the top hits come from Amazon, and you don't want to know what the bookseller has to say about the book. You want to know what the rest of the world has to say, so you can actually subtract them and move on. And you can apply the same logic to searching for things which, without including comm sites, commercial sites, or without including government sites, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned before that if you type in your name, the phone number, it'll be reverse phone book. You get a name. Can you opt out of that? Can you say, I don't want anybody to find out, so take my name out of your Google search list?
Yes, you can. There's an opt-out feature, and you can follow a link to do that. However, what I would advise is if you want to be opted out of there, because there are probably dozens of similar services throughout the Internet, is you should actually have your phone company make your number unlisted.
Oh, that's how you get it, from the phone company?
Yeah.
So if you have
the same listings that are in all the online white pages types of services.
Huh. Let's go to the phones. 1-800-989-8255 to Cleveland. Hi, Edward.
Hi there.
Hi.
Question. I actually was a big fan of Google until I discovered clustering technology, and I've actually found that I'm able to not bother with the advanced search parameters and restrictions and hacks and things just by relying on the clustering from, you know, for example, Vivissimo.
Tell us about that a bit more.
Well,
speak it. Try to speak in non-technical words for us.
it returns your results in a structure very similar to the file structure that you'd find in your PC, grouped prior to delivery by relevant topic or key. What I love is that I can do a more general search and then drop down through the subcategories and pop directly into a smaller subset that already has identified the area I'm looking for.
And what page do you find this on?
Well, it's actually the one that I work with is just vivissimo.com. Mm-hmm. It's just V-I-V-I-S-I-M-O. I'm under the impression that Google is probably working on something. I'm just curious as to their reaction to clustering.
Sergey?
We have developed a number of sort of internal clustering technologies over the years, and also some of these sites, like I'd have to check on Vivissimo, but some of these kinds of sites actually use Google underneath anyhow. You know, clustering is one of those things that, along with a number of other search technologies, is very helpful to a certain percentage of queries, and it's a little bit debatable how large a percentage that is. In many cases, when you're looking for something, it doesn't actually naturally break down into sort of a number of groups of topics, because even though, you know, all of us like to organize things, they, you know, there's not necessarily that underlying structure. And it's also something that we like to be very careful with our user interface. If we introduce, you know, new kinds of elements, we need to make sure that they're going to be useful to a significant enough proportion of the searches and the users compared to the distraction they would cause in other cases. But I think it's definitely a promising direction. I by no means would say that, you know, we're never going to run clustering on the Google site. And certainly we have a number of internal demos. In fact, I should check whether we've ever run anything on Google Labs. That's where we demo some of our technologies that we haven't put up on the production site. It's one of a number of, I think, innovations that you'll probably see over the coming years in more and more search engines, but you have to be really careful about how you apply them. And in many cases, I think it actually interferes with the experience rather than helps.
Thanks for calling, Edward. 1-800-989-8255. Should we be expecting to see more and more of Google on people's cell phones and things for instant data, you know, when they're out and they want to know some quick fact?
We've supported the major cell phone providers for a number of years. We have partnerships with almost all the big ones in the U.S. and also internationally. We support WAP, which is sort of primarily used in the U.S. and Europe. We support iMode in Japan. It's certainly not nearly as easy to search on a, you know, a little 2-inch display and to type things in using like 10 digits. So these things tend to get somewhat limited usage, certainly compared to people coming in through standard PCs. Mm-hmm. But I think there are other obstacles, such as just the latency and how fast they are, you know, these things can improve. And we get disproportionately much more usage from Japan on cell phones compared to sort of the rest of the world, just because I think they have tend to have slightly better devices.
Yeah.
They're more accustomed to typing in on them and so forth. So I think when the rest of the world catches up, and when the devices continue to improve, and people evolve new kinds of digits on their hands to actually deal with those little thumb pads, then I think we'll see much more usage.
We're all going to morph tiny fingers in evolution. We're talking about Google this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's see if we have a phone call or two left. Russell in Washington, D.C. Hi, Russell.
Hi. I'm a news junkie. I edit a publication called Corporate Crime Reporter, and I love especially Google News Alerts, which is this new thing where you type in, like I would type in corporate crime or guilty or bribery, and get all the news as it comes online.
How do you deal with the flood that must come in?
Well, you know, I actually couldn't get it to work, and I just tried it again, and it looks like it might now be working. This is a new thing, but it looks like it might now be working, so I haven't ever experienced it. But just searching the news is fantastic. I'd like to ask a couple questions, though. One, I'm not clear how Google makes money. I know you asked that earlier, but if you could go into more detail, how much money does Google make? How does it make money, and who owns the corporation?
Okay.
Quick note on the news alerts, which is that's on labs.google.com, which I mentioned, which is where we put up technology you can try out, and that's a fun one to try. As far as our financial model, most of our revenue comes from advertising. And so the ads that you see down the right-hand side of the search results that I mentioned, like the golf clubs example, and we actually run those not just on Google, but we have a large network of other sites, like they're on AOL, they're on Ask Jeeves, they're on lots of other search engines. And a new feature we deployed is we actually put them on non-search types of sites too. So if you have a site that's, say, about golf clubs and you subscribe to our AdSense product, then we'll actually run some ads on your site, from our golf club advertisers for you, and then we'll pay you the majority of the revenue from that.
How much money do you make, and who owns the company?
So we because we're private, we haven't been disclosing our financials thus far. But the ownership of the company is mostly in the hands of employees, of which, you know, the founders Larry and I are two, and we had some angel investors, including one of the founders of Sun, Andy Bechtolsheim, was in there, and we did have a venture investment from Kleiner Perkins and Sequoia.
Are you making money?
We've been profitable for almost 3 years now.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Sorry you didn't get in on that stock, huh? 1-800. Did anybody expect that you, or did you expect that this would be so successful so soon?
You know, when we formed the business plan originally, you know, I jotted down some numbers in the spreadsheet, and, you know, they sort of worked. It only went a few years out, but, you know, it sort of projected profitability and so forth. You know, when I looked back, actually, it was remarkable how close they were. But I think that was more luck than anything else. And considering the shifts that happened in the marketplace, dot-com boom and bust, the shift away from banner advertising to text advertising, which is, you know, the model that we thought would be more successful, but actually seeing that happen, it's all been really an incredible surprise, and I think we've been incredibly lucky.
All right. Thank you very much, both of you, for joining us. We've run out of time. We've been talking with Sergey Brin, President of Technology and co-founder of Google Incorporated, and Rael Dornfest, co-author of Google Hacks and Google Pocket Guide. These books are loaded with little gems of how to actually make the best use of Google. I highly recommend them. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And earlier we spoke with Congressman Sherwood Bollert and John Logsdon. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director, and our web producer and intern is Annalise Strachan. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Leski and Alphonse Vinn. And if you missed any of the stuff we talk about on Science Friday or the links that we mentioned and have a pencil ready, just go over to our website at sciencefriday.com and you'll find them, and you'll find the link to Google and where to get those Google tips. And also, you can also surf over to our website, leave us email there, and also find the Science Friday's Kids Connection, where you can get educational curricula based on Science Friday for use in your home and your classroom. It's free for your use. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.